The Napoleonic Era, Napoleon in Exile, 1815 to 1821, the Longwood Staff. Now, I've already talked about the main members of Napoleon's suite before. I've done that when they were getting ready to, well, when they all had to make that decision whether to go or not to go. The Bertrands, Gourgaud, Montholons, etc. But now it's time to look at other members of Napoleon's group and the wives, if you will, of Bertrand and Montholon. Now, all of these, we'll start with Fanny Bertrand. Now, Fanny came from an influential but reckless Irish Catholic family, the Dillons. Her father had fought in the Revolutionary Army, but died during the Reign of Terror. Her mother had quarreled with Josephine Beauharnais, which, of course, that's going to be Napoleon's wife. Her sister had actually married a man named Latour de Pin, who was an agent for Napoleon, whose mother and father had been part of the Ancien Regime. As a matter of fact, I own a document from the Napoleonic era where this gentleman is given a mayorship in a region. So he ends up being one of the perfects and later becomes a royalist in 1815. The Dillon family could boast of a distant relationship to the Empress Josephine, and this gave them a certain credit at court. Fanny was tall and elegant. With the help of her intelligence, willpower, or tears, according to the circumstances, she ruled over her husband. Napoleon had chosen for her, whom it was said she would have preferred a prince or a duke, but Fanny held herself like a queen when she entered a room. Dressed in her best, with her memoirs of the years of the vicegerent in Illyria, and the parties that her husband and her held, receptions, and carriages drawn by six horses, which indicated quite a significant step up. Remember, it was Fanny that tried to throw herself off the British warship when she learned that they were going to St. Helena. And as a result of surviving, she was pretty much embittered about going to the island. Next, we'll look at Albine Hélène de Montholon, Count de Montholon's wife. She is one of the most interesting figures of the entire Longwood party, even if only because of all the rumors that she was intimate with Napoleon. She was born into the Vassal family, or the La Vassale family, which had been ennobled by Louis XVI. Talk about a rotten deal. You finally become a member of the nobility, and it's through the king that's going to be overthrown. So it's very short-lived, to say the least. Now, her first husband was a Monsieur Bignon, but they were divorced. And her second husband was a Swiss businessman who she divorced only a few weeks before she met Charles Tristan de Montholon. An accommodating, some say ignorant, mayor married the two of them very quickly. Portraits of Albine show an agreeable, distinguished, and lively-looking woman. She was certainly an accomplished coquette, and you'll have to look that term up. It's more appropriate for the demi-mode period of the La Belle Epoque. It would indicate someone who was willing to have sex for gain, but not with a lot of people. She brought freshness and a good humor to the mixed company at Longwood, as well as being submissive to the whims of Napoleon. She sang beautifully, played the piano, and knew Italian arias that Napoleon liked. The room allotted to the Montholon was only separated from the emperor's by a simple pantry. Now we get to the head valet. That is Louis Marchand, born in 1791, employed in the palace in 1811, when his mother was the nurse to Napoleon's son, the Prince of Rome. He had experienced the splendor of court life when Napoleon's chief valet, Constant, deserted Napoleon on the way to Elba. Marchand took over. On Elba, his discretion and zeal gained him Napoleon's esteem. Marchand served during the exile as attentively as he had at the Tuileries Gardens. He was responsible for everything that added beauty and material comfort to Napoleon's life. If it hadn't been for Marchand, Napoleon might well have been reduced to wearing shirts that the English gave him. They say a man is never a hero to his valet, but few masters could be as simple and accessible as Napoleon was on St. Helena. The last days of power and glory had faded away, and now it was 1821, and Napoleon's final ordeal was at hand. Napoleon was a dying man on his bed, but the sheets must be changed. He must be turned. He must be washed. He must be shaved, not to mention all of the other sordid issues. And with great patience and love, Marchand did whatever the doctors ordered, whether it was emetics, salts of mercury, saltwater baths, foot baths, purgatives, enemas. Napoleon paid tribute to Marchand in his will. Quote, "His services were those of a friend, and he was one of the three executors of Napoleon, of his estate, along with General Bertrand and the Count de Montholon." Then we have the groom and the guard. Louis Etienne de Saint-Denis, known as Ali, was born at Versailles. He was the son of a servant during the Ancien Regime, but he received a good education in a notary's office before entering Napoleon's service as his groom. He took part in the campaigns in Spain and Germany, accompanied Napoleon on a state visit to Holland, as did Marchand. In 1811, Napoleon expressed a desire for a new Mameluke. Now, Rostam, who had been brought from Egypt, had been fired by Napoleon because of bad character. He must have been sleeping around with some of the people in the area. So, Saint Denis was chosen. So he dressed in Mameluke costume and was actually rebaptized Ali. On campaign, he was near Napoleon's side with field glasses, or his dressing case, or a bottle of brandy. On St. Helena, he was promoted to Napoleon's librarian. When his work in Napoleon's apartments was finished, he cataloged Napoleon's books, did copying for various members of Napoleon's entourage. Then we have just kind of the general major domo, the do-all character. This is Cipriani Francesi, just simply known as Cipriani. He was a Corsican and allied to the Bonaparte family. Cipriani's son was actually in the service of Napoleon's uncle, the Cardinal Fresh. He was a fanatical devotee to Napoleon. He joined Napoleon on Elba in 1814 and undertook a secret mission to Vienna at the time of the Congress being held there. He was not an outstanding spy or detective, but he was astute, and he could talk and make others talk. On St. Helena, he organized an information bureau that gave the English lots of trouble. He was clever at making fools of the soldiers guarding Napoleon. He died in 1818 of acute intestinal pain. Some people claim that he was poisoned by arsenic, but peritonitis also has to be considered. Now, I want to say something about arsenic. It is everywhere. They used arsenic to kill the rats that was in Longwood. And when they wallpapered the building, they painted lots of it, but there's some wallpaper on it. And the wallpaper, the glue that held it to the wall, actually had arsenic in it. Now, this is in the tropics. And there's always been this theory that when it got really hot and humid, that you could actually have the arsenic become airborne and kind of be part of the what you're breathing in. Now, arsenic is something that you can get used to over long periods of exposure. You need more and more and more of it to be a problem for you. But some people are very sensitive to it and could kill them relatively quickly. Now, the theory of the wallpaper has been proven to be possible because the Balcombes, Mr. Balcombe, that I've talked about the family, he was the man who supplied everything through the British East India Company for the entourage. And the family kept, in many cases, one of everything that was sent in. And it was discovered years ago that a roll of the original wallpaper was still in existence. And it was tested, and it did have arsenic in it. Then you also use it in stomach medications, all sorts of other stuff. Now, I also need to point out that if you're going to try and poison him, it is the greatest fear that the British government had. They did not want him poisoned because they knew full well that if he died on the island mysteriously, they would be blamed for killing him. So they were very astute in making sure that did not happen. So it is highly unlikely. So when we get to Napoleon's final demise, I'll go back through that. But the death of Cipriani was indeed a great blow to Napoleon because they were good friends. And the Corsicans have this close-knit feel towards one another. Napoleon spent a lot of money on Cipriani's tomb, but unfortunately it has vanished today. Although there are plenty of tombstones with the same date in the Plantation House Cemetery, that part of it is missing. And it is not unlikely that members of the family may have come to the island at some point and hauled it back. And then we have the other servants. Novarez is the Swiss servant in Napoleon's apartments. Perron is the official chef. There are two Archambault brothers who did the stables. There's Rousseau, who is in charge of the silver. Then there's Gentilini, a footman from Elba. He's quite the ladies' man, and the English women on the island loved him. And then Santini, who is the keeper of the portfolio. And he basically did everything from cutting hair to mending shoes for the entire entourage. So those are some of the other characters that are going to be floating around while Napoleon is in his exile, waiting for his ultimate exit from this world. Now, the sources for this are Napoleon St. Helena by Gilbert Martineau, Memoirs de St. Helena by Las Casas, Cashiers de St. Helena by General Bertrand, Who's Who on St. Helena by Dr. Chaplin, and The Journal of St. Helena by General Gogard. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, and if you really would like to help us continue, please support us with a donation or a purchase of a CD. Thank you very much.